Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from New American Short Stories. The writers select their own favorites, edited by Gloria Norris. Payment in Kind by Robley Wilson, Jr. That summer, she had the habit of getting up at first light, dressing quietly in the bathroom so she would not wake her husband, Paul, and going out to the kitchen to make coffee. Sometimes she used supermarket coffee, and once in a while, if the morning seemed in some indefinable way special, she would take from the cupboard under the sink the small brawn grinder her daughter Sarah had given her, and fill it with Colombian beans she bought at a specialty shop in Waterloo. The beans were small and dark and slippery. They reminded her a little of the Mexican jumping beans her father had bought for her to hold when she was a child, when she had been distressed to learn that the beans jumped because the warmth of her palms roused a tiny worm, some sort of borer, inside. It took only seconds to turn the coffee beans to powder. She held the contraption in both hands, her right thumb pressed against its orange button until the hum of the motor rose to a higher, freer pitch. When she unscrewed the plastic top and tipped the grinder over the percolator basket, the coffee that spilled out was fine and deep brown, almost as dark as the Iowa earth, and moist, so that she had to hit the machine a couple of times against the heel of her palm to loosen it. Then, while the coffee made in the old percolator, she went out to the front porch to assess the day. This summer, morning after morning, the days had been identical. A lip of yellow-orange along the eastern horizon, over which the light streamed into a bowl of sky that looked leaden, but would turn out to be a pale high blue. The air still seeming, when she breathed, all ready to carry nearly enough of the weight of heat to smother her. Ragged veils of fog hanging in the shallows of the fields that opened away from the farmhouse. And the mornings were not quite silent. The chorus of crickets was constant. There was almost always a solitary robin chirping in one of the ash trees. From the highway a mile to the north, she could hear the hollow roar of trailer trucks. Somewhere she had read that in silence, absolute silence, you could hear a high-pitched sound that was your own nervous system, and a deep boiling sound that was the circulation of your blood. Then the crickets might be her nerves, and far-off trucks her blood. She didn't know about the robin, something of the spirit, perhaps, that the scientists always left out. By the time Paul came into the kitchen, at 6 or 7, depending on what he planned to do with his day, the coffee would be half gone, and he would find her sitting at the table, cup in hand, staring idly out the screen door. He said nothing. He was a man of rare words. In all these years, she still could not claim to know him, but took a mug from the drainboard and poured an inch of coffee from the percolator. If his first sip told him it was a store brand, he filled the mug and sat opposite her, not like a man making himself comfortable with his wife, but on the edge of the chair, tense to go about some unannounced business. If the coffee was a Colombian, he would mutter something just below her hearing and empty the stuff into the sink. Either way, his next move was outside, to the weather station he had put together beyond the shed. Rain and wind gauges, tools for measuring temperatures and pressures and moistures, instruments acquired as a hobby, but consulted this year with a regularity bordering on the fanatic. No rain had fallen for 6 weeks. The heat rose into the 90s or hundreds. Day after sweltering day, humidities were high, the barometric pressure high, the wind sluggish. There were not even thunderstorms. After 10 minutes with his gauges, Paul would come in scowling. "Better close up the house," he said. Never more words than those, and her heart ached for him. This morning in mid-August, she watched him come back from the ritual of reading the weather and realized, as if for the first time, how old he had gotten, or tired, or whatever it was that happened to a man in 30 years of a working life. His movements showed none of the foolish energy that used to carry him like a caprice of wind from one chore to another, one outbuilding to another, one dream to another. He walked with his head down, his shoulders slouched, one hand tucked into a pocket of his overalls and the others rubbing absently at the back of his neck. When he came up the porch steps and through the screen door, his sigh was audible, a distress signal. "Better close up the house." She had heard the forecast on the television news last night. No relief, no rain, highs close to 100. In the southern part of the state, the government was letting the farmers turn livestock onto their set-aside land early, and some counties were already eligible for disaster loans. She could not recall such a summer. Paul stood in the middle of the kitchen. He looked as if he were trying to remember something, as if he had been on his way to a place, a task, and was disturbed to find himself in an unexpected setting. Then he turned toward the sink, took a tumbler down from the cupboard, and filled it with tap water. He studied the water before he drank it. Dear God, she thought, now is he fretting about the well? What is it? She said. He drained the glass before he responded, and when he did look at her, he compressed his lips in what she took to be an ironic smile. I was thinking of how my old man could have taken a look at the sky and at the weather vane on the old barn, he said, and known just as much about the damned weather as I do by reading all those dials. Oh, dear, she said, is this going to be the speech against progress? Something like that. Take a few minutes and have coffee with me, she said. You can spare me that. He pulled out his chair and brushed the orange cat off the seat. I'll sit, he said, but I'll pass on the coffee. He studied her. What's on the docket this morning? I'm going to can tomatoes, such as they are. Then I'm going into town with Nancy Riker. Paul heard this information without reacting, his thoughts already somewhere else, his eyes reading linoleum patterns off the floor. She drank her coffee. It was lukewarm and slightly bitter. I think I'm going to go into that West 40, Paul said. I walked through it yesterday. Looks to me like it might make 20%, but no more. You're going to chop it for silage? He nodded. Bert Stone can feed it to his damned cattle. He hauled himself to his feet. While you're in town, get me a six-pack of something. Most of the morning she spent dealing with the tomatoes. The drought hadn't done them any good. There were plenty of them, but they were small and hard, not anything she would have wanted to serve in a salad. It was hot work. By 10 o'clock the thermometer outside the kitchen window had reached 89, and that was in shade. She was interrupted only once by a woman in a gold Cadillac who rolled into the yard in a cloud of white dust and came to the back door to talk to her about Jehovah's Witnesses. In the middle of the serious question of salvation, Helen cut the woman short. It's a personal matter, isn't it? She said, and I've got tomatoes waiting. The woman went away. It was only when the Cadillac turned out of the yard that Helen noticed a man slouched in the passenger seat. Perhaps the woman's husband or father. He had an old face and wore a Panama hat. She thought how she hadn't seen a Panama hat in years and years. A thick cloud of dust followed the car down the road. All over Iowa, these gravel roads were like boundaries, defining the size and shape of the farm fields. Every mile of road to market, east, west, north, south, and heaven help the ignoramus who wanted to build a diagonal. West 40, that's where Paul was chopping down a cornfield that might have delivered 170 bushels an acre, but wouldn't touch 35 because of the weather. Probably she ought to have said to the Jehovah's Witness lady that she didn't believe in God anyway, that she had used to believe, but in the years of living on this farm with Paul, she had come to see how everything was up to her and to him. Now between them each spring they made something appear from nothing, just like any magic, any religious power, and how they controlled the earth and manipulated growing things, and almost but not quite used the weather to best advantage. She ought to have told her the roads and fences were what imposed order on the chaos. She ought to have said that eternity was only a succession of growing seasons, and if that were not argument enough, she could have talked about Sarah and about Peter and about the third child who never got named because he was stillborn. That might have been the last glimmer of her faith. Yes, probably it was. And she ought to have explained to the Jehovah's Witness lady about sweat and machinery and bank loans. And what did God know about all that? Helen waited until after 12:30 to have lunch, hoping Paul would join her even while she knew he wouldn't. She sat at the table in the kitchen, a glass of iced tea and a bowl of bran flakes with milk in front of her, listening to the simmer of the tomatoes on the stove. How much she had gotten used to being alone. Now that Sarah and Peter were gone, her life seemed almost reclusive, her marriage like the ritual passage of a man and woman on tracks that paralleled but rarely crossed. Yet this was to have been the year for her and Paul to rediscover each other. when the agriculture people announced in the spring that farmers could set aside as much as 80% of their land and be paid with surplus grains already stored, it had seemed to Helen that for the first time ever her husband would find time heavy on his hands. All the wives shared that belief. Helen remembered an evening in this very kitchen in March, when Paul and Burton Stone and Jess Erickson and Harvey Riker had sat playing a card game called Pepper and talked about pick, payment in kind, while she and the wives sewed in the side parlor. "It'll be like going back to the prairie," Stone had said, "like the Iowa I knew when I was a kid." "The hell," Paul said, "the Iowa you knew as a kid was leather jackets and switchblades. What's all this prairies crap?" Stone grinned. He was scarcely 30 years old, had come home from Vietnam to raise cattle on his father's land. "You know what I mean," he said. "Sure do," Riker said. "There won't be nothing growing on half my acres this year." "Not going to plant cover?" "Weeds cover." He filled his glass from a new bottle of beer. The foam spilled down the sides and puddled on the tabletop. "If I had horses, I'd plant broom or timothy, maybe alfalfa, but I don't." He lifted the glass and with the side of his palm brushed the spilled beer onto the floor. "You could do worse and get into the horse business," Jess Erickson said. "That paramutuals bill going through. There'll be racetracks all over." "You could raise greyhounds," Paul said. "They're legalizing dog tracks, too." "They make it legal to race Hereford," Stone said. "I'll be sitting pretty." "Paul here ought to open a bicycle shop," Riker said. "Now the county supervisors have given the old railroad right-of-way to the bike people, there'd be lots of business real close by." Paul made a show of looking at his cards one by one. "Play the damn game," he said, refusing to be baited. Much later, when the pepper was finished and the men had gone home through the crisp night, Helen lay beside Paul in bed and thought about the spring planting. "I suppose it might be all right," she said, "letting things go a little way back to nature." "Don't get all romantic," Paul said. "It's just for this year. Nobody's inviting the Indians back to chase buffalo." "Maybe we could do more things together." He raised himself on one elbow. "You think I ought to sign up for this PIC program? Weren't you planning to?" "I might," he lay back. "I might set aside that northeast corner where I need to put in tile. I'd probably have the time, and Harv might want to do the tiling on his side." "You should talk to him about it," she said. Of course he would find a way to avoid leisure. That was Paul. He had chuckled then. "That kraut SOB," he said, "giving me grief about that damn bicycle trail. He knows how I feel. He knows the railroad people promised to give me back the right-of-way if they ever closed down the line." Finally, she rinsed her dishes and left them in the sink. It was time to pick up Nancy Riker. Paul could make himself a sandwich when he felt like it, if he ever decided to come back to the house before dark. The shed was a small, white-clappered place on the outskirts of town. It was a man's restaurant, local farmers, truckers passing through, but the two women stopped in for coffee on the way home from the shopping mall. At the largest of the chrome and formica tables, men in overalls were talking and joking. The men's conversation was not steady. Long periods of silence intervened, so that what was said made a pattern of loudness and silence, a rhythm appropriate to custom and long friendships. Neither Nancy nor Helen had bought much. Helen had rummaged through the remnants in a fabric shop until she found a length of cotton she might make into a summer shirt for Paul, and she had stopped off at Hy-Vee to buy his six-pack of Old Milwaukee. Nancy had bought nothing, had seemed to fall further and further into depression as she followed Helen past the rows of stores in the mall. She was a year or two younger, a small, solemn-eyed woman whose black hair was shot through with gray, and whose skin was so pale as to seem translucent. Now she sat across from Helen, digging through her purse until she found a cigarette package with two cigarettes left. She offered one to Helen. "No," Helen said. "Thank you." She had not smoked in nearly 10 years. She didn't propose to start again. "I don't know why that shopping mall upsets me," Nancy said. She lit the cigarette, then immediately set it to smolder in the ashtray. "At least it was cool. I think it's something to do with all those children, those teeny boppers or whatever they call them now. How can they bear to just wander like that?" "I suppose it's that they're young," Helen said. The coffee arrived. She poured a little sugar into her spoon and stirred it into the cup. "Do you think they look forward to anything?" "I certainly hope so," she smiled at Nancy. "Am I reassuring?" she thought. "Doesn't everybody?" I wonder, sometimes evenings I drive the highway into Waterloo, and I see those 13 and 14-year-old girls standing at the corners leaning against the traffic light poles. I swear I almost know how they feel, waiting for something, not really knowing if they'll recognize it when it arrives. I think it's always a boy with a car, Helen said. And what scares me, Nancy said, is maybe they're more like us than we give them credit for. No, Helen said, for us it was a boy with a tractor. Isn't that the truth? She stubbed out the unsmoked cigarette. Do you ever try to imagine what life would be like if you hadn't married a farmer? No, not since the first 2 or 3 years. I do, Nancy said. Dear God, I do. Helen waited, but Nancy only looked down at the coffee cup cradled in her palms and shook her head. I thought about being married to a different kind of farmer, Helen said. I've thought, what if we kept hogs? She saw the shiver in Nancy's shoulders, hoping the movement meant laughter. Oh, Helen! Nancy raised her head. The barest trace of tears glistened at the corners of her eyes, but she was giggling. Hogs, Helen! The smell, the dirt, the awful noises they make, and they eat people! Hog heaven, Helen said. Living high off the hogs, Nancy said. She got a handkerchief out of her purse and dabbed at her eyes. Hog City, she subsided. I'm sorry, she said. You're such a funny person when you want to be. And sometimes I do want to be, Helen said. She glanced around the cafe. The men were still self-absorbed. The waitress was at the cash register sorting through meal checks. You have to be able to laugh at yourself. It's such a crazy way to live. This is the worst yet. I know, you can't think life is all strawberries and cream with Paul and me. I don't even get a civil sentence out of Harvey. I lie awake these hot nights, and I think I'd rather be anywhere else, doing anything else, anything. Years and years ago, when Sarah and Peter were both nutty about riding, I did used to think Paul and I could have made a good thing out of raising horses. The war in Vietnam was still on. Sarah had that wonderful quarter horse Paul picked up at the sale barn in Waverly, and Peter talked us into buying him that huge gelding, Lopez, that was part quarter and part thoroughbred. 16 and a half hands. I thought we'd have to carry a stepladder so Peter could get up on him. She smiled, remembering. Why did the very thought of horses make her sentimental? Peter was 10 or 11, I can't think which. Sarah stayed with horses a long time, Nancy said. She had a year of college left when she finally decided she couldn't keep up with it, couldn't really give Cloud the care and the exercise. I'd forgotten what she called it. Red Cloud. He was a chestnut gelding. She picked up the check and looked at the numbers. Sometimes I wish we'd gone into the horse business. The weather wouldn't affect us quite so much. I mean, it would affect feed prices, but it couldn't wipe us out. There's other things, Nancy said, like in Texas a few years back. Equine something. Recall they used to have that margarine commercial on the television about not trying to fool Mother Nature? That's what's wrong with marrying a farmer, and it doesn't matter if you raise corn or beans or pigs or horses. You can't fool Mother Nature, but it's okay for Mother Nature to fool you. Why not let me buy the coffee, Helen said. In the pickup on the way home, they sang Girl Scout songs, and when Helen pulled into the Riker farmyard, Nancy reached out to give her a sweaty hug. You're always good for me, she told Helen. You're the nicest person I know. Just in the time since she'd been at the mall, a portable sign had appeared in front of the Erickson's produce stand. Sorry, closed for the season. Thank you. Garden dried up. The stand was shuttered tight. The fields beyond the Erickson house and barn and tool shed were either brown or bare. She should tell Paul. He would shrug, look off into that space where he could not be followed. She turned off the blacktop onto the county road. Inside the fences, the fields of corn were brown, straggly, worthless. Only the ditches showed anything growing, and even the green weeds were faded under a thick coating of dust. Nancy's misery was commonplace. They all felt it. What sort of life was it, that you could be 50 years old, a good mother, a patient wife, a strong worker, yet you had no more money or leisure or happiness than the day you chose the risk of marriage? Even the mailbox mocked her, its support made from an old plowshare painted vivid red, and the box in the shape of a barn with Tobler printed on its sides as if her husband's name were no different than a billboard for mail pouch tobacco. She stopped at the box, a pleasure horse magazine she had never had the heart to cancel, even after Peter left home. A letter from her mother addressed in the failing hand that sent a chill of fear through her, if she let herself think about it. Paul's farm journal. She laid everything on the seat beside her. Driving up the narrow lane to the house, she saw that the farmyard was crowded with young people on bicycles, perhaps a dozen of them, all on the flimsy English bikes of her childhood, fenderless, with handbrakes and skinny tires, the curious loop of chain at the rear axle, the high pointed saddle seats that always looked too uncomfortable to be sat on. Some of the bikers wore white helmets that perched on the top of their heads and strapped under their chins to make them look like hockey players or TV roller skaters. Boys or girls, they wore cutoffs that showed off their lanky tanned legs and sneakers without socks or colorful biking shoes with knee stockings. Some of them had on T-shirts with slogans, "Scrambled eggs and beer, not just for breakfast anymore," or "Bikers are better lovers." The girls had blonde hair streaked from too much sunlight and long dark hair that flowed down to their narrow waists and short boyish cuts that caught in damp curls against their foreheads. Most of the men had mustaches or beards. They looked like brothers from an enormous family. Paul was in the midst of them shouting and Helen's heart sank. This had happened before in April when the bikers brought a petition asking support for a bike trail along the old Illinois Central right-of-way. Paul refused to sign, and long after the railroad had given the land to the county, he was still furious, had tried to form a committee with other farmers, but gave up when Jess Erickson accused him of wanting to lead a goddamn bunch of vigilantes. Only Harvey Riker had been on Paul's side. She parked the pickup in the shade of the barn and approached the group. "I've got a living to make," she heard Paul say. "You think it makes me happy to see good farmland wasted?" "It's already done," one of the bikers said. "The county's already made it a bike trail. All we're asking is for you to meet us halfway, respect our right to use it, and help us protect it." Now Helen could see they were not all young people. They were various ages, late teens to late 30s, and they were serious-faced, intent. "A strip of land that size might make the difference between profit and loss for me someday," Paul said. "Next spring I've got to plant fence line to fence line. If this year doesn't put me in the poorhouse." A bearded man nearby turned his front wheel toward Helen and winked. "Farmers," he said, "I've never met one yet that wasn't losing his shirt. They only keep farming because it's so much fun." She wondered whether or not to be angry with him. "I'm his wife," she said. "You have to understand that he's telling the truth. That land was his, at least it was his grandfather's before the railroad needed it." "This is only about the bridge," the bearded man said. "The icy bridge over the West Fork. Some farmers out in Winthrop set fire to a bridge just like it. Really wasted it. We're talking to all the farmers around here, asking them to keep an eye out for that kind of thing." "My husband's not one of your fans," Helen said. "We're not asking him to love us. Just live and let live." Helen smiled at him, liking him. "That seems simple enough." She went on to the house, put the mail on the table and the six-pack into the refrigerator. The air in the kitchen was humid with canning heat. A solitary fly buzzed against one of the windows. "Wasted," the young man had said, and she wondered if he had been in Vietnam, one of the lucky ones who came back unhurt. She went upstairs and changed into a pair of blue shorts she would never have considered wearing outside the house, and came down to the kitchen. Paul was standing at the door looking out. The bicyclists were just turning onto the gravel road, bent over their handlebars like jockeys, a glitter of sun dancing off their machines. "What do you think of that?" Paul said. "I think it was polite of them to talk to you." "You know what's going to happen," he said. "Kids littering the place with trash from McDonald's, soda cans, candy wrappers, wrecking the fences." "They aren't all kids," she said. "Some of them are nearly as old as you or me." "Second childhood," Paul said. "Then we'll have beer cans along with the soda cans and condoms instead of candy wrappers." He went to the refrigerator, took out one of the cans of beer she had just put in. "That'll be warm," she said. She opened it anyway. "What's a strip of dirt mean to somebody who can spend $300-$400 on one of those fancy bicycles?" he said. "Oh, Paul." But words to argue with him wouldn't come, as if she couldn't betray him even when she wished to. "I know," he said. He sat heavily and laid his cap on the table. "It isn't like me to bitch all the time." "It's a drought," she said. "It's everything. I chopped that field this morning and just got madder and madder. I thought 5 or 6 weeks from now we'll get a damned foot of rain and it'll be too late. Just like this spring, so much rain I couldn't go into the fields to put the seed in. He took a drink from the warm can and made a face. What I know is I need land one whole hell of a lot more than a bunch of overgrown babies on two-wheelers. You'll have the pick money, she said. And that's a joke. He gave her a look that was nearly scornful. I didn't have the brains to set aside that much, and anyway, it's the big company farms that'll rake in most of the pick money, and the grain dealers that'll get rich, handling corn from 5 years ago all over again. He set the beer can aside. It's the principle of the thing, he said. President Franklin Pierce gave this land to my great-great-grandfather, the only decent thing that the government ever did for the Tobler family. No one ought to ask me to give it up, not any of it. It's such a tiny bit. I don't care if it's no bigger than a postage stamp. He put on the cap and yanked its bill down over his eyes. I'm going into town where the beer's cold, he said. But the bike trail doesn't matter, she wanted to say, watching him climb into the cab of the pickup, hearing him grind the gears in frustration. It's the weather and the government both, and you can't beat either one of them. For the rest of the day, she tried to keep busy with odd jobs. She hauled the sealed mason jars down to the basement and shelved them alongside the green beans she had done the summer before. She thought about the young man, who was probably a Vietnam veteran, and how fortunate it was that Peter had been too young for that war. She did the laundry, though she might have put it off another day or two, and got out the mending basket to do some odds and ends she had been saving for cooler weather. Once she looked up from sewing a shirt button to see that the light had changed sharply. Clouds, she imagined. In the excitement of thinking there might be rain, she went outside for a moment to look westward, but it was simply dust in the air. It was not like Paul to solve his problems by drowning them. To have a few drinks, that was all right, but he hated to be drunk, to feel he had given up control. What he liked, and it mostly amused her, was to clown with her, to giggle, make bad jokes, pat her buttocks. But lately, she could not say what had changed, something that frightened her, a desperation, a willfulness. Dear heaven, if I can't put my mind on something pleasant, I'll start inventing trouble when there's already plenty to go around. One summer, when the children were still young and at home, still interested enough in horses to feed and groom them as well as ride them, Helen took them to Kentucky, to the marvelous green expanse of the world around Lexington, to visit the horse farms. Paul had not gone, couldn't go, he said. The land needed him. The second day she drove to Calumet Farm, still full of the pleasure of Walnut Hall the day before, where Sarah and Peter had driven a foreman crazy with questions. Walnut Hall didn't breed racehorses. The children, Peter especially, had begged Calumet. But when the three of them arrived at the Calumet gate, they were stopped by a sign, no visitors. Sarah took the matter calmly, acidly. If they think they're too good for us, that's fine with me. Peter whined. Helen was disappointed. Beyond the forbidden entrance, they could see white buildings trimmed in red, with red-roofed cupolas. So near and yet so far, she said to Sarah. In Lexington, she tried to make up for the morning's failure by taking the children to a fancy restaurant, but there was no forgetting. Peter was impossible, Sarah merely petulant. After the dismal lunch, she went to a public telephone and looked up the Calumet number in the book. "I'm terribly sorry," said the woman who answered the phone. "Calumet Farm is open for persons in the horse business, not for tourists." "I'm here with my two children," Helen said. "We drove all the way from Iowa. As it happens, we own a quarter horse named Cloud and a part thoroughbred named Lopez. Does that put us in the horse business?" There had been a lovely silence. "You all come on ahead," the woman said. "Park at the main office and I'll find a man to show you around." Then they had been everywhere, except the breeding barns, the stables, the tack rooms, the meadows surrounding. In Helen's memory, the fences were an astonishing white, the trim of the buildings a dark, perfect red, the bluegrass deep and green. She and the children had reached through the rails to stroke the blazes of chestnut-colored yearlings with names engraved on brass plates riveted to their halter straps. Sunglint, Morning Sun, names she had never forgotten. And even grown up and scattered, Sarah and Peter remembered Citation, a Triple Crown winner, an enormous bay stallion, nearly 25, shambling alongside his groom like a solemn old man lost in his memories. Years later, when she read of Citation's death, Helen had wanted to cry, had left the room so Paul wouldn't question her. That wonderful summer, traveling without Paul, coping with 2 children, gaining them entry to a forbidden place, it had been the proudest and happiest event of all her married life. She woke up in the black of night, alone in the bed. Paul's side had not been slept in. Neither his warmth nor his reassuring man-smell was on the bedclothes. She imagined him sitting in the D-town tap, drinking beer and quarreling with the others. Farmers, some of them, but laid-off factory workers, too, and truckers between hauls. A small army of men whose occupations had lost their value or vanished entirely. Sensible family men getting drunk. She looked at the alarm clock on the nightstand on Paul's side of the bed. Its greenish-yellow hand showed nearly 4 o'clock. The tap closed at 2. If he'd gone off to play Pepper with his usual cronies, he would never have stayed out so late. He wasn't the sort to sit in a pickup on a back road and drink beer with a buddy. Hadn't done such a thing since coming home from Korea 30 years ago. She got out of bed and went to the bathroom. In the harsh glare of the overhead light, she closed her eyes and touched the lids with her fingers. Her hands were hot on her cheeks. The nightgown clung to her back and sides. It used to be that you could depend on the nights to cool down. It used to be that you closed the doors so you and your husband could say silly words to each other in whispers that wouldn't alert the children. To what? To the secret that you cared more for each other than for weather and work? She tidied herself, turned out the light, went through the hallway and gingerly down the front staircase. This year everything was weather. The sun, dry days, a crying need for rain. The dust would be far worse when the farmers in Kansas and Nebraska did their fall plowing. Then in late September and October she would notice the whole western sky dark orange, like the eerie approach of a tornado, and for days the tawny dust would be thick on everything. Cars and trucks and machinery, window sills and porch railings. When it rained, and finally it would pour, Paul was right. If you caught the rain in the bucket or pan, it would be murky with Plains dirt. All those concerns lay between Paul and herself. Those and more. Practical matters like credit at the farm fleet, credit for parts needed to overhaul the machinery in time for spring plowing and planting. And what to plant, how much to plant, what would the government do next? Helen understood, without being able to tell Paul, in Paul's language, that what absorbed and frightened him likewise frightened her. Dear Paul. She felt her way down the front hall, unlatched the screen door, and stepped onto the porch. A slight warm breeze brushed across her face and bare arms and sighed in the branches of the nearest ash. Too early for the robins. The night was almost black. There was no moon. But off to the east she saw the glow of light that was Waterloo, and south of that the lesser glow that must be Vinton, and due south from where she stood a throbbing of light she could not at first make sense of. It seemed to be, it was, where the old IC right-of-way met the West Fork. Dear Paul, she wanted the light to be anything safe. A campfire, a bonfire tended by some of the college students having a kegger to celebrate the beginning of classes. False dawn. She went back to bed to wait. Certainly she knew the old railroad bridge was burning, and her husband was too simple and direct not to have done it. Probably with Harvey, the two of them drunk and angry after the tap closed up. And how easy it would have been, how thorough. She had seen fence posts kindled by spring fire set in the roadside ditches that burned for days, slowly into the heart, and she imagined the timbers of that bridge, black with creosote, dry with age, smoldering long after the fire department volunteers had done all they knew to do. She could imagine the seeds of flame growing in the scars carved by axes and chisels when the bridge was built, and the charred wood steaming when the first rains touched it. Oh, the things we say we love, she told herself, dozing and waking in the stifling room, and the things we do to prove it. She got up for good at 6:30 and made coffee from the Colombian beans, standing at the sink to watch the misty light dissipate in the fields. Paul was not home. There was no telling when he would appear, whether he would be sheepish or arrogant, whether he might have Harvey Riker with him, to soften the consequences of what he had done, the way a boy brings home a friend to shame his mother out of her anger. Yet she might be mistaken, jumping to wrong conclusions. And even if she were right, the worst of that was the way Paul would expect her to take his side, see his reasons, help him explain. He would never see that he was trying to lead her to a place where she ought not to follow. What should she do, she wondered, for this unhappy man? When the sheriff's car came down the gravel road from the east, kicking up the dust that would add one more layer of white to the weed leaves and stems. Helen thought at first it was the Jehovah's Witness lady in the gold Cadillac. As if I'd tell her what I really believe. Then she saw the bubble of light on the roof and recognized the county shield on the front door. She watched the car stop near the tool shed, watched the young deputy stride toward her in his morning fresh khakis. As if I'd tell anybody. And that story was Payment in Kind by Robley Wilson, Jr., from New American Short Stories, The Writers Select Their Own Favorites, edited by Gloria Norris. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from the same book, We Are Norsemen by T.C. Boyle. We are Norsemen, hardy and bold. We mount the black waves in our doughty, sleek ships and go a-raiding. We are Norsemen, tough as stone. At least some of us are. Myself, I'm a skald, a poet, that is. I go along with Thorkel, son of Thorkel the misaligned, and Colbeen Snub when they sack the Irish coast and violate the Irish children, women, dogs, and cattle, and burn the Irish houses and pitch the ancient, priceless Irish manuscripts into the sea. Then I sing about it, doggerel like this. Fell I not, nor failed at fierce words, but my piercing blade mouth gave forth bloody bane speech, its harsh teaching. Catch the kennings? That's the secret of this skaldic verse. Make it esoteric and shoot it full of kennings. Anyway, it's a living. But I'm not here to carp about a skald's life. I'm here to make art. Spin a tale for posterity. Weave a web of mystery. That year the winter ran at us like a sword, October to May. You know the sort of thing. Permafrosting winds, record cold. The hot springs crusted over, birds stiffened on the wing and dropped to the earth like stones. Thorkel the old froze to the crossbar in the privy. Even worse, thin-ribbed wolves yabbered at our doorstop, chewed up our coats and boots, and then, one snowy night, made off with Thorkel the young. It was impossible. We crouched round the fire, thatch leaking, and froze our norns off. The days were short, the mead barrel deep. We drank, shivered, roasted a joint, told tales. The fire played off our faces, red, gold, and amber, and we fastened on the narrator's voice like a log on a dark sea, entranced, falling in on ourselves, the soft cadences pulling us through the waves, illuminating shorelines, battlefields, mountains of plunder. Unfortunately, the voice was most often mine. Believe me, a winter like that, a skald really earns his keep. 6 months, 7 days a week, and an audience of hard-bitten critics with frost in their beards. The nights dragged on. One bleak morning we saw that yellow shoots had begun to stab through the cattle droppings in the yard. We stretched, yawned, and began to fill our boats with harrying materiel. We took our battle axes, our throwing axes, our hewing axes, our massive stroke-dealing swords, our disemboweling spears, a couple of strips of jerky and a jug of water. As I said, we were tough. Some of us wore our twin-horned battle helmets, the sight of which interrupts the vital functions of our victims and enemies and inspires high-keyed vibrato. Others of us, in view of 15-degree temperatures and a stiff breeze whitening the peaks of the waves, I felt that the virtue of toughness had its limits. I decided on a lynx hat that gave elaborate consideration to the ears. We fought over the gravel break to launch our terrible swift ship. The wind shrieked of graves robbed, the sky was a hearth gone cold, an icy froth soaked us to the waist. Then we were off, manning the oars in smooth Nordic sink, the ship lurching through rocky breakers, heaving up, slapping down. The spray shot needles in our eyes, the oars lifted and dipped. An hour later the mainland winked into oblivion behind the dark lids of sea and sky. There were 13 of us, Thorkel, son of Thorkel, the misaligned, Thorkel the short, Thorkel Thorkelson, Thorkel cat, Thorkel flatnose, Thorkel neb, Thorkel ale lover, Thorkel the old, Thorkel the deep-minded, Ofag, Skeggy, Grim, and me. We were tough, we were hardy, we were bold. Nevertheless, the voyage was a disaster. A northeaster roared down on us like a herd of drunken whales and swept us far off course. We missed our landfall, Ireland, by at least 200 miles and carried past into the open Atlantic. 8 weeks we sailed looking for land. Thorkel the Old was bailing one gray afternoon and found three menhaden in his bucket. We ate them raw. I speared an albatross and hung it round my neck. It was no picnic. Then one night we heard the cries of gulls like souls stricken in the dark. Thorkel, ale-lover, keen of smell, snuffed the breeze. "Landfall near," he said. In the morning the sun threw our shadows on a new land, buff and green, slabs of gray, it swallowed the horizon. "Balder be praised," said Thorkel the Old. "Thank Frigg," I said. We skirted the coast, looking for habitations to sack. There were none. We'd discovered a wasteland. The Thorkels were for putting ashore to replenish our provisions and make sacrifice to the gods. In those days we hadn't yet learned to swallow unleavened bread and dab our foreheads with ashes. We were real primitives. We ran our doughty, sleek warship up a sandy spit and leaped ashore, fierce as flayed demons. It was an unnecessary show of force, as the countryside was desolate, but it did our hearts good. The instant my feet touched earth, the poetic fit came on me, and I composed this verse. New land, new found beyond the mickle waves by fell men fish. Their stark battle valor failed them not. No Edda, I grant you, but what can you expect after 6 weeks of bailing? I turned to Thorkel, son of Thorkel, the misaligned, my brain charged with creative fever. Hey, I shouted, let's name this newfound land. The others crowded around. Thorkel, son of Thorkel, the misaligned, looked down at me. He was 6'4", his red beard hung to his waist. We'll call it Newfoundland, I roared. There was silence. The twin horns of Thorkel's helmet pierced the sky. His eyes were like stones. Thorkel land, he said. We voted. The Thorkels had it 9-4. For 2.5 weeks we plumbed the coast, catching conies, shooting deer, pitching camp on islands or guarded promontories. I'd like to tell you it was glorious. Golden sunsets, virgin forests, the thrill of discovery and all that. But when your business is sacking and looting, a virgin forest is the last thing you want to see. We grumbled bitterly, but Thorkel, son of Thorkel the misaligned, was loath to admit that the land to which he'd given his name was uninhabited, and consequently of no use whatever. We forged on. Then one morning he called out from his place at the tiller. Ha! He said, and pointed toward a rocky abutment 100 yards ahead. The mist lay on the water like flocks of sheep. I craned my neck, squinted, saw nothing. And then suddenly, like a revelation, I saw them. 3 tall posts set into the earth and carved with the figures of men and beasts. The sight brought water to my eyes and verse to my lips. But no sense in troubling you with any dilatory stanzas now. This is a climactic moment. We landed, crept up on the carving, sly and wary, silent as stones. As it turned out, our caution was superfluous. The place was deserted. Besides the carvings, fanged monsters, stags, serpents, the grinning faces of a new race, there was no evidence of human presence whatever, not even a footprint. We hung our heads. Another bootyless day. Ofig, the berserker, was seized with his berserker's rage and wound up hacking the 3 columns to splinters with his massive stroke-dealing sword. The Thorkels were of the opinion that we should foray inland in search of a village to pillage. Who was I to argue? Inland we went, ever hardy and bold, up hill and down dale, through brakes and brambles and bogs and clouds of insects that rushed up our nostrils and down our throats. We found nothing. On the way back to the ship, we were luckier. Thorkel Neb stumbled over a shadow in the path, and when the shadow leaped up and shot through the trees, we gave chase. After a good rib-heaving run, we caught what proved to be a boy, 11 or 12, his skin the color of copper, the feathers of birds in his hair. Like the Irish, he spoke gibberish. Thorkel, son of Thorkel the misaligned, drew pictures in the sand and punched the boy in the chest until the boy agreed to lead us to his people, the carvers of wood. We were Norsemen, and we always got our way. All of us warmed to the prospect of spoils, and off we went on another trek. We brought along our short swords and disemboweling spears, just in case, though judging from the boy's condition, he was bony and naked, his eyes deep and black as the spaces between the stars. We had nothing to fear from his kindred. We were right. After tramping through the under and overgrowth for 30 minutes, we came to a village. Smoking cookpots, skinny dogs, short and ugly savages, their hair the color of excrement. I counted 6 huts of branches and mud, the sort of thing that might excite a beaver. When we stepped into the clearing, tall, hardy, and bold, the savages set up a fiendish caterwauling and rushed for their weapons. But what a joke their weapons were! Ofig caught an arrow in the air, looked at the head on it, and collapsed laughing. It was made of flint. Flint! Can you believe it? Here we'd come, Frigg knows how many miles for plunder, and the best we could do was a bunch of Stone Age aborigines who thought that a necklace of dog's teeth was the height of fashion. Oh, how we longed for those clever Irish in their gold brooches and silver inlaid bowls. Anyway, we subdued these screechers, as we called them, sacrificed a whole lot of them to the gods. The way I saw it, we were doing them a favor, headed back to our terrible swift ship, heavy of heart. There was no longer any room for debate. Ireland, look out! As we pointed the prow east, the westering sun threw a shadow of the new land over us. Thorkel the Old looked back over his shoulder and shook his head in disgust. That place'll never amount to a hill of beans, he said. And then it was gone. Days rose up out of the water and sank behind us. Intrepid Norsemen, we rode the currents, the salt breeze tickling our nostrils and bellying the sail. Thorkel Flatnose was our navigator. He kept 2 ravens on a cord. After 5.5 weeks at sea, he released one of them, and it shot off to the sky and vanished. But in less than an hour, the bird was spotted off starboard, winging toward us, growing larger by turns, until finally it flapped down on the prow and allowed its leg to be looped to the cord. 3 days later, Flatnose released the 2nd raven. The bird mounted high, winging to the southeast, until it became a black rune carved into the horizon. We followed it into a night of full moon, the stars like milk splattered in the cauldron of the sky. The sea whispered at the prow, the tiller hissed behind us. Suddenly, Thorkel Ale-lover cried, "Land ho!" We were fell and grim and ravenous. We looked up at the black ribbon of the Irish coast and grinned like wolves. Our shoulders dug at the oars, the sea sliced by. An hour later we landed. Ofig was for sniffing out habitations, freebooting, and laying waste. But dawn crept on apace, and Thorkel, son of Thorkel the misaligned, reminded him that we Norsemen attack only under cover of darkness, swift and silent as a nightmare. Ofig did not take it well. The berserker's rage came on him, and he began to froth and chew at his tongue and howl like a skinned beast. It was a tense moment. We backed off as he grabbed for his battle axe and whirred it about his head. Fortunately, he stumbled over a root and began to attack the earth, gibbering and slavering, sparks slashing out from buried stones as if the ground had suddenly caught fire. Admittedly, berserkers can be tough to live with, but you can't beat them when it comes to seizing hearts with terror, battling trolls, demons, or demiurges. Our reaction to all this was swift and uncomplicated. We moved up the beach about 200 yards and settled down to get some rest. I stretched out on a patch of wildflowers and watched the sky, Ofig's howls riding the breeze like a celestial aria, waves washing the shore. The Thorkels slept on their feet. It was nearly light when we finally dozed off, visions of plunder dancing in our heads. I woke to the sound of whetstone on axe. We were polishing the blade edges of our fearsome battle weapons. It was late afternoon. We hadn't eaten in days. Thorkelneb and Skeggy stood naked on the beach, basting one another with black mud scooped from a nearby marsh. I joined them. We darkened our flaxen hair, drew grim black lines under our eyes, chanted fight songs. The sun hit the water like a halved fruit, then vanished. A horned owl shot out across the dunes. Crickets creaked in the bushes. The time had come. We drummed one another about the neck and shoulders for a while. "Yeah!" we yelled. "Yeah!" fastened our helmets and then raced our serpent-headed ship into the waves. A few miles up the coast, we came on a light flickering out over the dark corrugations of the sea. As we drew closer, it became apparent that the source of light was detached from the coast itself. Could it be an island? Our blood quickened. Our lips drew back in anticipation. Raven and Rapine at last, and an island no less. What could be more ideal? There would be no escape from our pure, silent fury, no chance of secreting treasures, no hope of reinforcements hastily roused from bumpkin beds in the surrounding countryside. Ha! An island it was. a tiny point of land slick with ghostly cliffs and crowned with the walls of a monastery. We circled it, shadows on the dark swell. The light seemed to emanate from a stone structure atop the highest crag, some bookish monk with his nose to the paper, no doubt, copying by the last of the firelight. He was in for a surprise. We rode the bosom of the sea and waited for the light to fail. Suddenly Thorkel the Old began to cackle. "That'll be Inishmurry," he wheezed. "Fattest monastery on the west coast." Our eyes glowed. He spat into the spume. "Thought it looked familiar," he said. "I helped Thorir Paunch sack it back in 75. Then the light died and the world became night. We watched the bookish monk in our mind's eyes, kissing the text and laying it on a shelf, scattering the fire, plodding wearily to his cell in the cold gray pallet. I recited an incendiary verse while we waited for the old ecclesiast to tumble into sleep. "I bleed monk, night his bane. Darkness masks the sea wound. Mickle fell, mickle stark." I finished the recitation with a flourish, rolling the mickles like thunder. Then we struck. It was child's play. The slick, ghostly cliffs were like rolling meadows, the outer wall a branch in our path. There was no sentry, no watchdog, no alarm. We dropped down into the courtyard, naked, our bodies basted black, our doughty, death-dealing weapons in hand. We were shadows, fears, fragments of a bad dream. Thorkel, son of Thorkel the Misaligned, stole into one of the little stone churches and emerged with a glowing brand. Then he set fire to two or three of the wickerwork cells and a pile of driftwood. From that point on, it was pandemonium. Ofig tumbling stone crosses, the Thorkels murdering monks in their beds, Skeggy and Thorkel the Old chasing women, Thorkel ale lover waving joints of mutton and horns of beer. The Irish defended themselves as best they could, two or three monks coming at us with barbed spears and pilgrim staffs, but we made short work of them. We were Norsemen, after all. For my own part, I darted here and there through the smoke and rubble, seized with a destructive frenzy, frightening women and sheep with my hideous blackened features, cursing like a jay. I even cut down a doddering crone for the sake of a gold brooch, my sweetheart Thorkella in mind. Still, despite the lust and chaos and the sweet smell of anarchy, I kept my head in my poet's eye. I observed each of the principal Thorkels with a reporter's acuity, noting each valorous swipe and thrust, the hot scalded verses already forming on my lips. But then suddenly I was distracted. The light had reappeared in the little chapel atop the crag. I counted Thorkels, no mean feat when you considered the congeries of legs and arms, sounds and odors, the panic flocks of sheep, pigs, and chickens, the jagged flames, the furious womanizing, gormandizing, and sodomizing of the crew. As I say, I counted Thorkels. We were all in sight. Up above, the light grew in intensity, flaming like a planet against the night sky. I thought of the bookish monk and started up the hill. The night susurrated around me, crickets, katydids, cicadas, and far below the rush of waves on the rocks. The glare from the fires behind me gave way to blackness, rich and star-filled. I hurried up to the chapel, lashed by malice aforethought and evil intent. Bookish monk, and burst through the door. I was black and terrible, right down to the tip of my foreskin. "Arr!" I growled. The monk sat at a table, his hands clenched, head bent over a massive tome. He was just as I pictured him, pale as milk, a fringe of dark pubic hair around his tonsure, puny and frail. He did not look up. I growled again, and when I got no response, I began to slash at candles and pitchers and icons and all the other superstitious trappings of the place. Pottery splashed to the floor, shelves tumbled. Still he bent over the book. The book! What in Frigg's name was a book anyway? Scratchings on a sheet of cowhide. Could you fasten a cloak with it, carry mead in it, impress women with it, wear it in your hair? There was gold and silver scattered round the room, and yet he sat over the book as if it could glow and talk or something. The idiot. The pale, puny, unhardy, unbold idiot. A rage came over me at the thought of it. I shoved him aside and snatched up the book. Thick pages, dark characters, the mystery and magic. snatched it up, me, a poet, a Norseman, an annihilator, an illiterate, snatched it up and watched the old monk's suffering features as I fed it, page by filthy page, into the fire. Ha! Huh. We are Norsemen, hardy and bold. We mount the black waves in our doughty sleek ships and go a-raiding. We are Norsemen, tough as stone. We are Norsemen. And that story was We Are Norsemen by T.C. Boyle from New American Short Stories. The writers select their own favorites, edited by Gloria Norris. And now from Pushcart Prize, Volume 44 from the year 2020, edited by Bill Henderson. Dearest Water by Nancy Takis. In the searing heat of Dead Horse Point, looking over a vertical cliff, I walk near the corral where unwanted horses were once left to die. You have given us saliva in this rim of crimson, an altar cloth of air, your distant promise. Seeing your green curve at the bottom of this canyon, they broke out and leapt to their deaths. My own thirst cruises like a lantern over hoodoos and dry tides. Your scent steams like a live secret water, my good memory. I am thirsty for the lost. And that is Dearest Water by Nancy Takis, from Pushcart Prize, Volume 44, edited by Bill Henderson. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and bye for now.